I found out on my way to Harlem. Ellington, you don't live around here. He moved away one day, so they say, from Harlem. I can hear his echo still. Now, 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 you can't keep me away from where I was born. I was baptized by my daddy's horn. I know that Marvin Gaye used to play right here. Somebody say you can't keep me away from where I was born.
Hearing this wonderful song again today by Gregory Porter, On My Way to Harlem. This is from his 2012 album, Be Good. And Harlem figures prominently in our discussions again today as we follow up on part two of Jeffrey Perry's presentation, Hubert Harrison, Father of Harlem Radicalism. We talked yesterday about this extraordinary man who was way ahead of his time in almost every single way, but particularly in formulating the ideologies that we ought to strongly consider as we implement our own, and the whole the tightening, if you will, of this ring, the global African ring that people had been so fragmented in because of the experience of imperialism and of slavery. But he brought it all together. He brought the African identity all together and undergirded it with a very extraordinary and penetrating ideology that gives us a basis for how we see ourselves as African people and how we are to interpret this global system of oppression. So he was way, way, way ahead of the game on that score and took the time and took the care to write things down, in order to share with people, to give them something to consider. And in fact, many did. Many of the early leaders in the African political movement, people like Marcus Garvey, people like, my mind is going blank because there's so many crowding in at the moment, A. Philip Randolph, Martin Luther King, and others, in one way or the other, can trace the political ideologies they developed directly to Hubert Harrison. We are so fortunate to have our dear friend Perry, Jeffrey Perry, who has inventoried the Hubert Harrison papers. They are now at Columbia University's Rare Book and Manuscript Library. And he's the editor of a Hubert Harrison Reader, printed by Wesleyan University Press in 2001, and Harrison's When Africa Awakes, the inside story of the stirrings and striving of the new Negro in the Western world. That was in 2014. And also, he is the author of Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918. So we have an extraordinary privilege of being coursed through the writings of Hubert Harrison and being introduced to Hubert Harrison by this scholar who is not your basic academic. He is a working class scholar. And I got to know him particularly in connection with another book that I strongly recommend. I tell people all the time, you have got to have this book in your library, and that is Theodore Allen's The Invention of the White Race. So it is with great pleasure that we welcome you again, Jeff, to the podium and to course us through the second half of your program today.
Great, Eutrice, and thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to share Harrison with you and your audience. Again, I want to just start, as I did yesterday. I have a webpage, which is simply my name, www.jeffreybperry.net, which has lots of information for free on Harrison and Allen. And I'd also like to suggest that listeners, if they find Harrison to be of importance, which I think they will, Allen to be of importance, to try and make sure your public libraries have these books so others can have access to them. With that said, I want to pick up where we left off. I had given yesterday an overview of Harrison and started talking briefly about his Crucian roots, his roots in St. Croix in the Danish West Indies at the time. Now it's the U.S. Virgin Islands. And he came to New York in 1900 and settled. First, he was in the area on West 62nd Street, the most densely populated area, African-American, Afro-Caribbean, most densely populated area in Manhattan. And then he moves up to Harlem. And when he moves to Harlem, he's living most of his time at 231 West 134th Street, which is between 7th and 8th Avenue. And again, the most densely populated block in Harlem. So Harrison is always of the people, and he lives in poverty essentially his whole life. Now, I was ending, and I talked about how he started his diary and some of the entries in his diary. But around that time, he also makes a significant intellectual break. And that break is the break from religion. This was the period of historical criticism in various circles in the U.S. and internationally. People were reading the Bible more critically, finding historical inconsistencies. And there was something of a movement from the last few decades of the 19th century into the 20th century. And Harrison, who read widely, read much of this literature. And he ultimately came to find great difficulties in the authenticity of the Bible and also in the role that Christianity and the Christian church had played in the slave trade. And so he around 1909, in that period, 1908, 1909, he breaks from religion. And he documents this in his diary. And this, again, is where the diary is so important, because he just, he reveals himself. He says, "I divorced myself from orthodox and institutional Christianity. I suffered. Oh, how my poor wounded soul cried out in agony. I saw the whole fabric of thought and feeling crumbling at its very foundations. What had gone was the authenticity of the Bible. That which I had been taught was the word of God. I now had a new belief, agnosticism. I said belief, but what I meant was a philosophy of life, like Huxley," and he's referring to Thomas Huxley. He refused to put Darwin's bulldog, if you will, Thomas Huxley, who coined the word agnosticism, I refuse to put faith in that which does not resist insufficient evidence. He chose instead to look the universe in the face, to believe in the sanctity of human nature, and to develop a deep sense of responsibilities for his action. In his diary, he concluded this very long and moving passage with the following: I prefer to go to the grave with my eyes wide open. And he, as he proclaimed, now I am agnostic. It was an agnostic of the ilk of Huxley. And he goes, to Huxley, agnosticism was not a creed, but a method, the essence of which was the fundamental axiom of modern science. Follow your reason as far as it will take you, and do not pretend that conclusions are certain which are not demonstrated or demonstrable. So in that period, the free thought movement essentially held, advocated thought free of religious dogma. They emphasized the human origins of the Old and New Testaments, denied the infallibility of the Bible, emphasized reason over supernatural authority, and encouraged free inquiry, free discussion, free publicity of ideas, and a scientific method. To varying degrees, a number of people that your listeners are probably familiar with were free thinkers. People like in the women's movement, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, Margaret Sanger, Horace Greeley, the anti-slavery editor, Thomas Wentworth Higginson, Clarence Darrow, the attorney, Eugene V. Debs, the socialist, Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, right, the author, Lucy Parson and Emma Goldman, A. Philip Randolph, Carl Sandburg, and a number of important Afro-Caribbean thinkers, J.A. Rogers, Claude McKay, Rogers from Jamaica, McKay's from Jamaica, Cyril V. Briggs, who's from Nevis, Richard B. Moore from Barbados, Hodge Kiernan from Montserrat, and even W.E.B. Du Bois, who, of course, is born in Great Barrington, Mass., but has Caribbean roots. And in his biographer, David Levering Lewis, this is not emphasized in the biography, but in another article he wrote, he writes, and I quote, that Du Bois was an agnostic and an anti-clerical. This was not promoted widely. But so there were a lot of people, you know, thinking, trying to think independently on that. So that is a shaping influence on Harrison. He is going to begin to approach social problems, from a scientific perspective, if you will. And it's a significant break because it breaks from his worldview, but also because the black church, particularly in the U.S., is the most powerful institution in the black community. So again, he's stepping out. That first step forward is often a deviation from the norm, and that was the case with Harrison in this case. In this period also, 1908-1909, he marries his wife, Irene Louise Horton Harrison, becomes Harrison, who comes from British Guiana at the time, the Demerara region, by way of Antigua, Puerto Rico, and to the United States. And they would eventually have five children. And they get married in this period, in 1908, first child, 1909. And as Harrison is continuing his intellectual development, and he's active with the Lyceums of St. Benedict the Moor on 53rd and St. Mark's, he's also active with speaking at the YMCA, the YWCA, the White Rose Home, wherever he has the opportunity to speak. He starts keeping scrapbooks, and I'm an archivist of sorts, and I appreciate this very much. Today we keep files, right? But in his day, he would take old magazines that he could get access to, you know, that were available free, presumably free, and he would put covers on them, and then he would put newspaper clippings inside each one, and he would organize by subject. So during that first decade in the 20th century, one of the big disputes was between Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois over the direction for the African-American community. And in that early period, Harrison considered himself a Du Bois man, as he phrased it. Du Bois represented more of a protest movement and motion than he felt Booker T. did. And in his scrapbooks, he had one entitled Subservience, And in that, Booker T was featured prominently. Now, Booker T, I keep some of these clippings together myself. And Booker T. Washington had said of President Theodore Roosevelt in one famous quote, famous to me at least, "I will oppose nothing that he wants done and will help forward all that he desires to have done." So that might qualify as a subservient, right? Now, but Booker T. goes to London and then to Copenhagen in 1910, and he issues some statements while abroad essentially saying that conditions are not so bad for African Americans in the U.S. And Du Bois gets together a group of about 50-some-odd more prominent people, and they issue letters of protest about Booker T's statements. Harrison, who's working in the post office, and forgive me, I hadn't mentioned, he starts working in the post office in 1907, and that's a very significant job. It's a job he can support his family, and he's working usually the night shift. And even when he's working the night shift, he's so active because in his diary, he documents how he and fellow co-workers have study groups that meet after they get off the night shift at 2 and 3 in the morning, and they have study groups. And they're writing to people in the Caribbean and elsewhere. There was a Black Independence Party kind of in Cuba around 1907, and they're corresponding with these people. And some very good and longtime future activists are involved with this. So Harrison's working in the post office, and from the post office, he writes two letters to the New York Sun, which is a daily newspaper in New York. And what he comments on Booker T's statements, and he says, essentially, Booker T, you're free to say what you want, but you should really tell the truth. And then he goes on to, make the argument that conditions are not so good for Black people at all in the U.S. And Booker T, who's the most powerful Black man in America at that time, he has a what's called the Tuskegee machine, which is all his contacts and associates. He's supported by very powerful whites, Rosenwald, Carnegie, and people like that. And he gets in contact through his assistant, Emmett Scott, with people in New York through Charles W. Anderson, who's the leading Black Republican in New York, and a fella named Edward Morgan, who's the postmaster of New York City. And essentially, they have Harrison fired for writing these two letters. Now, a few things about that. One, to this day, the largest post office building in New York City on West 39th Street is Morgan Station, named after this postmaster. And the documents that I'm describing are in the Booker T. Washington papers, where they talk about how they got rid of Harrison. Now, I was a former postal worker and a union steward and official. I knew how to get records. And I went back and got his records from the turn from 1911. And when he was fired from the post office, he was summarily fired. He had a clean, what they call POD-7. His record was clean. And then he summarily fired for these letters. So this is a very dastardly thing that Booker T had done. You take the livelihood from a man. Harrison at this time had his wife, I think, was pregnant with the second child. And within another 2 years, they'd have two more. They have four children at that early page. The fifth came in 1920. So, again, very – and a lot of the biographies of Booker T don't even mention this, but I think it's part of the story that should be told. So Harrison certainly is not in the camp of Booker T, but in this period of 1909-1910, the NAACP is also founded. And it's the founding is essentially done here in New York at some meetings and there's some coverage of the meetings. And in it, there's some coverage that comes out in the press in subsequent days. But Harrison notes that some of the most pointed, and they get a European-American, African-American activists together, right? But Harrison notes that some of the most pointed comments from the African-Americans are elided from the coverage. And his antennas go up. He says, this is no way for this organization to start. It can't be shaped based on white people's expectations of how Black people should act. And so in this early period, he has some beginning you know, criticisms and wariness of the NAACP. He felt it didn't have any answer to what happens if the white minds at which you are aiming remain unaffected. And he thought it was overly limited by white people's views of how black people should act. In the same period, Du Bois becomes editor of the NAACP's Crisis magazine. And Du Bois, in this period, was advocating and promoting, as he did for a few decades more, the concept of the talented tenth, the educated and gifted who must be made leaders of thought and missionaries of culture among their people. And Harrison starts developing a criticism of that, too. He's not putting these out all the time publicly at first, but he didn't feel that the talented tenth had provided the leadership that was needed. He thought that they should come down from their Mount Sinai, so to speak, and get amongst the people. And he didn't think that the, quote, colored leadership was preordained to lead. And that gets into deeper issues in terms of who were the talented tenth. And but so he starts developing this wariness. So after he's fired from the post office, he turns to work in the Socialist Party, turns to some full-time work. He's able to get some full-time work in the Socialist Party. Now, the Socialist Party in this period was a significant, probably relatively, it grows into the highest point for a left organization in the history of the U.S., at least in that, certainly up until that time. In 1908, it had 40,000 members and got 3% of the votes. And its platform was, you know, fairly progressive on many issues. It was anti-monopoly. It encouraged nationalization of industries. It advocated an eight-hour workday, which was, you know, a major demand. Graduated income tax, progressive income taxation, women's suffrage. None of the major parties were advocating women's suffrage, and public works program. By 1912, the Socialist Party was up to 6% of the vote, and Harrison was an active campaigner for the Socialist Party. Now, while with the Socialists, Harrison writes the first major theoretical series by an African-American on the Negro and socialism. It's the first such comprehensive analysis. And in it, he does a number of things. He starts explaining and articulating how racial oppression should be understood as socio-historical, not biological. He proposes a new litmus test for socialists to champion the cause of African Americans as a revolutionary doctrine. He thinks this is what they should be doing, and it's a key to a revolutionary strategy. He emphasizes the duty of all to oppose race prejudice, and he advocates for a colored socialist club and emphasizes the need for special appeals to reach African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans, etc. Now, in that period, the Socialist Party had women's clubs, they had foreign language federations, so they were making outreach efforts to other groups, other categories of peoples in this area, and he felt that fit right in with it. And the party supported him for a couple months, but not very long. Now, he also offered some major additional theoretical contributions. One, and in his series of writings, the one that first attracted me to Harrison, and let me step back for a second. The way I came to Harrison, I was working in the post office and very active in the union, and I was also going to school, and I was writing a dissertation addressing the question of why no socialism in the U.S. under two very fine scholars, Nathan Huggins, who was at Columbia and later founded Du Bois Institute at Harvard, or was the first chair, I guess, and Hollis Lynch, who's from Trinidad and Tobago, and a wonderful historian, and his daughters have carried on much of the struggle in various ways. I was addressing the question, why no socialism in the U.S., and increasingly focusing on white supremacy as the principal retardant of the movement and the reason why the movement wasn't getting further and the issue that had to be dealt with. And in the course of my studies, one thing led to another. I read a little about this guy named Hubert Harrison. I couldn't find much. I went up to the Schomburg Center, and I found his two books, which were online, his two books, Negro in a Nation, written in 1917, and When Africa Awakes, The Inside Story of the Stirrings and Strivings, New Negro in the Western World, written in 1920. This was when microfiche was how you got these documents, so I got them on microfiche, or microfilm, and I printed them out, and I took them home and read them, and I was arrested by the clarity of his thought. I was familiar with all the contemporaries of his age, of his era, and I thought he was head and shoulders of all of them. And two issues in particular struck me, because one of the questions I was constantly dealing with was, how do we get European-American workers to oppose racism and white supremacy? How do we deal with that? And Harrison challenged, as did Allen, the other person I work on, challenged what I argue in various things I write, the two main ideological props of white supremacy. The idea that racism is innate, because if racism is innate, why fight it? You can't do anything about it. And the second idea is that, quote, white workers benefit from race prejudice. And Harrison was clear, as is Allen, no, the bosses benefit from this. This is not in your interest. What's in your interest is solidarity with your African-American brothers and sisters, right? And Harrison was clear on that. So he was talking class interests. Another thing he did, which was very important, was the Socialist Party back then, and you still see similar debates today in various aspects of the left, is the Socialist Party was divided somewhat in two main trends. One group advocated political or evolutionary road to socialism, let's get people elected to office, and the other advocated industrial revolutionary socialism, let's have militant strikes, and push our way to socialism that way. And Harrison tried to appeal to each wing of the Socialist Party with the argument that their duty is to champion the cause of the Negro. If you want to make political gains, you need black voters. If you want to make industrial gains, you need black workers. And so he constantly emphasized the duty is to champion the cause of the Negro. And he also felt that this duty to champion the cause of the Negroes was the key answer to why no socialism in the U.S., which was the question I was dealing with years later. But a book had come out also around 1906 by a German scholar named Werner Sombart, who was addressing that question. So this was a question that was of concern, and Harrison was proposing the way forward. Now, another thing that Harrison did in his theoretical writings was a concept, and this is one I always try and pass on to current and future generations, and this he writes in 1911 in that series on the Negro and the Socialism. He writes, politically, the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. The presence of the Negro puts our democracy to the test and reveals the falsity of it. When I first read that, I thought I knew what a touchstone was, but I wasn't quite sure. So I, looked it up. And for those who might be like I was, not so familiar, a touchstone is a black stone. If you think you've got gold, if you think the metal you've got is gold, you rub it against it to see if it's really the gold that it's purported to be. And it's an extraordinary metaphor, because I think we can use that in any issue we look at in society: housing, unemployment, incarceration rates, life expectancy, health care, pick an issue. Any issue we look at, let's put it to the test. How are black people faring, and what are we going to do about it? It's kind of a guide for a direction forward. And Harrison also, in that same paragraph, goes on and essentially writes, the first part is what I'm injecting, but at the end is what his exact words, true democracy and equality implies a revolution startling to even think of. And I think that passage foreshadows the 1960s, when the civil rights black liberation struggle is a catalyst for so many important movements for social change in this country, for the anti-war movement, the student movement, the women's movement, gay and lesbian rights, labor movement, right? Everybody, these movements take sustenance from the civil rights, black liberation struggle. And why? I think there's a number of reasons, but some of the paramount reasons are, one, because the cause was just, and two, because it hits so directly at how the ruling class maintains social control in this country. That brings us to Alan again, social control. But I think Harrison is right on point with these. So not to get too dialectical, but Harrison as a thinker understood, I believe, the twofold character of democracy in America. If it's a lily white democracy, lily white trade unions, lily white Republican Party, it's a retardant to social progress. But if it's a thoroughgoing democracy and it challenges white supremacy, it paves the way forward. And I think he understood that. So in this period of 1912, he's active with the Socialist Party. And he campaigned. The Socialist Party candidate in that period is Eugene V. Debs. And Harrison campaigns actively for Debs, very actively, all over. He's a tri-state. He's upstate New York. He's all over New York City. He's in New Jersey. He's in Connecticut. The New York Times, on September 14th of 1912, writes a little piece on Harrison speaking. And it's entitled Enlightening Wall Street. And it talks about an eloquent and forceful Negro speaker, Hubert Harrison, shattered all records for distance in an address on socialism in front of the Stock Exchange yesterday. This is at Broad and Wall Street. His voice carried to the furthermost limits of the crowd. He was still going strong at the beginning of the third hour, and he continued until the big gong in the exchange announced the closing. So he basically went from 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock speaking on socialism to a crowd as far as the voice could reach on Wall Street in front of the Stock Exchange. I now point out when I give my talks, this is certainly a pioneering occupation of Wall Street, and it's important for the Occupy Wall Street people to know some of this history, know some of the background. So as he continues to lecture in this period, he lectures as often as 23 times a week. He's tireless. That's 7 days a week, over 3 times a day. But there's a list of all his talks. Henry Miller, who's a very famous novelist, particularly of the 60s, goes to hear him at Madison Square, the old Madison Square in New York, around 23rd Street. And he can't believe what he's seeing and hearing. And he writes, there was no one in those days who could hold a candle to Hubert Harrison. With a few well-directed words, he had the ability to demolish any opponent. And he goes on in paragraphs describing this great orator. Harrison also starts writing for the major publications of the Socialist Party, the International Socialist Review. And one very brilliant piece he writes is a reply to Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling had written about the white man's burden, and Harrison writes a piece entitled The Black Man's Burden, and he goes, well, let's look at the facts. And he puts that out in that article. Another thing he does in his series on socialism and the Negro in the International Social Review is he writes the following. The mission of the Socialist Party is to free the working class from exploitation, and the duty of the party to champion the Negro's cause is as clear as day. This is the crucial test of socialism's sincerity. Now, Harrison writes that in 1912. A year later, W.E.B. Du Bois writes, the Negro problem then is the great test of the American socialist. So Harrison precedes Du Bois by a year, and with this very important point, right? But most people are only familiar with Du Bois's quote, but even a little more background on that is Harrison writes it when he's campaigned vigorously for Debs. Du Bois, when his piece comes out in 1913, he has left the Socialist Party. People may not be aware that Du Bois left the Socialist Party to campaign and support Woodrow Wilson. Now, Woodrow Wilson, as people may or may not know, after he comes into office, and of course he had a track record before then too, but when he comes into office, He segregates federal workplaces, post office, and others. And he brings the Birth of a Nation into the White House, the filming of the Birth of a Nation. He sends troops into Haiti, Dominican Republic, Mexico. And in 1916, although he runs on an isolationist platform, you know, stay out of the war, by 1917, he leads the U.S. into the war nominally to make the world safe for democracy. Harrison has much more to say on that, and I'll discuss that later. But so Harrison's writings, Harrison writes Southernism or Socialism, a major piece before the Socialist Party convention. And he says, which? What's going to be the direction of this party, Southernism, white supremacy, or socialism? And he, again, reemphasizes duty of the parties to champion the cause of the African-American. At that 1912 party convention, Socialist Party doesn't even discuss the Negro question. But they do discuss Asian immigration. And in the discussion on Asian immigration, Their committee comes out with the following. Their position is that race feeling is not so much a result of social as of biological evolution. It is deeper than any class feeling and will outlast the capitalist system. Class consciousness must be learned, but race consciousness is inborn and cannot be wholly unlearned. To Harrison, this was the core of that white supremacist, that racist argument that racism is innate, you know. And, of course, it was a horrible position they took on against Asian immigration. Socialists, one of the worst positions in the history of the left. So one other thing that Harrison does while he's in the Socialist Party is the following. When he's writing these series, he writes, and this is 1912, the 10 million Negroes of America form a group that is more essentially proletarian. And under slavery, they were the most thoroughly exploited of the American proletariat. Now, this is a very important and profound concept, and I'll try and offer a few reasons why in a second. But what's important to know is in 1935, when Du Bois writes his seminal book, Black Reconstruction, which has reshaped much understanding of U.S. history, he writes, the labor movement, with few exceptions, never had the intelligence or knowledge as a whole to see in black slavery and Reconstruction the kernel and meaning of the labor movement. This important point that black labor, enslaved black labor, was proletarian leads to a much deeper and more profound understanding of U.S. history. I would argue it does several things right off the top. It provides examples of some of the most valiant struggles in labor history. It helps us to tear the covers from centuries of, quote, white labor's betrayal and apologies, betrayal of black labor. And on a deeper level, and this gets into Allen's work, it helps us to understand the invention and role of the white race as a ruling class social control formation. Because as Allen describes, back in the 17th century, you had European-American and African-American laborers in solidarity fighting together, and the ruling class turns to break that up. It's a history many people are not familiar with. I encourage people, if they're not familiar with it, if they go to my webpage, I have I think it's a fairly good video on it. It runs about 2 hours with slides. They might enjoy it. In this period, Harrison also supports the industrial workers of the world. That's probably the left wing of the labor movement at that time. And they're advocating one big union, but they also advocate racial equality far to the left of the Socialist Party on this issue. Direct action, sabotage, organized 25,000 Brotherhood of Timber Workers in the Deep South. And in Paterson, New Jersey, not far from where I live, in 1913, there's a great strike, Paterson Silk Strike of 1913. And Harrison goes there to speak along with Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Big Bill Haywood, a number of the very famous or well-known at the time IWW leaders. And according to local Paterson papers, he gives the most fiery speeches. He was right on mark with a lot. And he's very involved in these struggles. And recently, I guess about 3 or 4 issues back, Harper's did a piece on the Botto House, which is now the American Labor Museum, which is one of the places that Harrison spoke, and I sent them a wonderful photo I had of Harrison, Gurley Flynn, Big Bill Haywood, and they talked about this, about his role in labor history, right? But by 1914, Harrison is disenchanted with the Socialist Party. And there's a number of more slights over the next couple of years in terms of when he tries to speak publicly, and he's not getting support in any way. And so as he leaves, Hubert Harrison offers what I think is probably or arguably most profound but least heeded criticism in the history of the U.S. left. He says that the Socialist Party, like the labor movement, has insisted on white race first and class after. It put the white race first before class. Very deep. Too bad we didn't know more about Harrison earlier. We could have been paying attention to this more. And this, again, is a reason why I think Harrison's, and Harrison leads into Allen in places like this. Now, I'm going to pick up the slack a little bit because I'm conscious of time. So in the period, after he leaves the Socialist Party, Harrison speaks at a radical forum. He speaks on free thought, free speech, birth control, racial aspects of the war. He speaks at a place called the Modern School, which had a lot of the contemporary thinkers of the day, Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, George English Walling, Clarence Darrow. And they had on their staff anarchists, single taxers, IWW leaders, some NAACP leaders, muckrakers. And he speaks there for about a year or two. And he also puts forth some in-print criticisms of Christianity and the role that the church had played in opposing abolitionists and supporting slavery. Harrison also, in this period, around 1915-16, early starts putting out some predictions on the racial significance of the war that is developing in Europe. And he says that that European conflict is over colonial possessions, and one of the effects will be to awaken racial and national consciousness in the non-white areas of the world. And in this way, white Europe would sow the seeds of its own destructions in the war for imperial control. And second, on the domestic level, he forecast a sweeping tide of racial consciousness, which would soon, in fact, happen. He's speaking on the street corners, and James Weldon Johnson and a woman named Gertrude Cohn, who works at the 135th Street Public Library, encourage him to start bringing all his talks up to Harlem and concentrate in Harlem. James Weldon Johnson, listeners are probably familiar with, wrote the Negro National Anthem. He was a diplomat. He's a prominent NAACP leader, and he was a writer for the an editorial writer for the New York Age, the city's leading black weekly at the time. And he encouraged Harrison to give a series of talks. He said it would be like a university extension carried to the furthest point. They want Harrison to come speak in the community regularly. The final step for Harrison was he starts doing a series of pieces on the Negro theater. There's a beginning movement of the Negro theater in Harlem, and Harrison looks at the role that black actors and black playwrights and even the black audience play. And it's very profound and deep analysis. And for those who are interested and who involved in theater today, many of the same issues that are being dealt with today, Harrison began to address back then. So, again, he's on cutting edge with all of this. So by 1916, Harrison is advocating the importance of building race unity from the bottom up. He writes that the fault with previous efforts was that the uniters, such as Washington Du Bois, had generally gone at the problem from the wrong end. They began at the top when they should have begun at the bottom. An attempt to unite the intellectuals was not the same as uniting the Negro masses, the key to racial solidarity. I'll just parenthetically point out, in 1940, in Du Bois's third autobiography, Dusk of Dawn, he comes to that conclusion, but for those early decades, he wasn't. So Harrison sets out to found this new Negro movement. It's going to be race-conscious, internationalist, mass-based, advocate political equality, social justice, defense of self, family, and race in the face of lynching and white supremacist attacks. It's going to be proactive. It's not going to be dependent on white support. It's not going to wait around for it. It's going to oppose lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement. The meeting, he founds the Liberty League, in 1917, and at the founding meeting, it's at Bethel Church on 132nd Street in Harlem, Woodrow Wilson had led the U.S. into World War I to make the world safe for democracy, and Harrison in the flyer, and the flyer has listed as speakers Adam Clayton Powell Sr., the lead speaker was Harrison, Chandler Owen, and Garvey gets invited up to speak at the platform, but Harrison's the featured speaker, and the flyer for it is Stop Lynching and Disfranchisement, Make the South Safe for Democracy. So in response to Wilson's Make the World Safe for Democracy, they're saying let's make the South safe for democracy. Let's start here. So Harrison made clear that this new Negro movement that was being formed was a breaking away from the old a breaking away of the Negro masses from the grip of the old time leaders. It opposed lynching, segregation, disfranchisement. It was for enforcement of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. Now that's basic civil rights. This is a precursor to what we see later on in this development of the civil rights movement. And a lot of people, you know, tie it into other groups. In different periods, the historians have gone from the 50s to the 40s, 30s, and even to the 20s about the roots of the civil rights movement, but they haven't come all the way back here to Harrison yet, a lot of the contemporary historians. But one of the key issues, and Harrison's newspaper, The Voice, demands a political voice, and he's preaching militant armed self-defense. At these rallies, he's standing up and saying, if we're going to be attacked, we're going to fight back. We're going to with arms, right? But another key distinguishing feature of Harrison's movement was the demand for federal anti-lynching legislation. And in this, he finds he has a cohort in William Monroe Trotter up in Boston. But why is federal anti-lynching legislation department important? Well, there's over 100 black people a year being lynched. It's a horror that Harrison has been writing on, and people, you know, are offended by, you know, throughout the African American community. And but what people don't know is the NAACP, which, you know, would make some comments on it and protest it a little, refused to argue for federal anti-lynching legislation. And why was this the case? As is documented in my book, but I go through the primary sources, because they didn't want to alienate Southern white support, right? So what happens is, now, when Harrison founds this Liberty League, another thing I should point out is people were coming around, and a lot of people who are going to be major figures in the Garvey movement within the next few years join Harrison's Liberty League, including Marcus Garvey himself. And for people who are familiar with Garvey's history, they know he's not one to be joining anyone else's organization, but he joins Harrison's organization. And in the books, I have quite a number of quotes by people like Anselmo Jackson, one of the writers for Garvey's Negro World and Harrison's paper, and others, talking about how Harrison's influence on Garvey was the major radical influence on Garvey in this period. Moving more quickly, in East St. Louis, In July of 1917, shortly after he founds the Liberty League, there's a major, what Harrison calls a pogrom on the African-American community. World War One, black workers are coming up Mississippi from down south, and they come to East St. Louis. They're looking for jobs, and there's major attacks on the African-American community fueled by white labor leaders, Samuel Gompers and a fella from the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, I believe. They're inflaming the situation. They're talking about these black workers taking white men's jobs. And the number of people killed, I forget the exact number right now. It's estimated from 39 to 250, as I recall. But so Harrison calls protests in Harlem over this. And again, urges we got to fight back with militant armed self-defense if we have to. Now, what's interesting about this, again, for current generations, is East St. Louis is 12 miles from Ferguson, Missouri, right? And so 100 years later, we have the almost 100 years later, we have the Ferguson protests, but Harrison's fighting similar struggles back in 1917. One last thing, Harrison is consistent with his Liberty League in emphasizing a political voice and international duty, and his organization develops a tricolor flag, and the colors of the tricolor flag are black, brown, and yellow, because they're the colors, he says, that we are domestically and internationally. Now, Garvey, within a few years, switches to the tricolor that people are familiar with, yellow, black, green, and yellow. Wait, is it? Red, black, and green. Forgive me. And we have the tricolor flag. Then what's the last thing I want to mention today is in 1918, Harrison and Trotter decide to call a Liberty Congress to protest World War One, and they're going to hold that in Washington, D.C., and they do hold it in the end of June. There's men and women from 35 states. And in order to undermine that, Joel E. Spingarn, who's the head of the NAACP, again, the NAACP doesn't have black national leadership for his first few decades. Spingarn is the head. And he is a few other things, too. He is a major in military intelligence. His role is to monitor the black and radical community, and he is a pro-war. He's pro-war. And he's also, by Du Bois's own admission, Du Bois's closest white confidant. So he tries to undermine the Liberty Congress. He doesn't have success, but he talks to Du Bois, and in the process, he gets Du Bois to advocate what they wind up calling is a colored editors' conference to meet before the Liberty Congress in an attempt to steal the thunder. And in the process, he talks to Du Bois, and they talk about Du Bois getting a captaincy in military intelligence. Hear this, Du Bois, a captaincy in military intelligence. And as part of the quid pro quo, Du Bois writes an editorial entitled Close Ranks. It's the editorial he's most embarrassed about in his entire life, I think. And in it, he writes, "Let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances." And everybody knows what they are, lynching, segregation, and disfranchisement. "And close ranks shoulder to shoulder with our white fellow citizens." So it turns out Du Bois doesn't get the captaincy. Trotter and Harrison hold their conference. Harrison exposes Du Bois. Du Bois really never wants to talk to Harrison again, you know, because of Harrison's open criticism of him. So that's where I'm going to end for today. This is where volume one of the biography ends. But by 1918, Harlem is considered the center of radical black thought. Harrison is the leading voice of Harlem radicalism. He's recognized as a brilliant orator, writer, thinker, and activist. He had led in challenging capitalism and white supremacy, leading black theoretician and socialist party, founder of the New Negro Movement, and he laid out broad parameters, I think, that would shape and influence much black and radical discourse for the remainder of the 20th century. Thank you.
Well, I got to tell you, Jeff, this has been a rousing analysis, and you relate it so well. And I hope, just from the information that you have shared, and it's about, what, 10% of what you have?
Yeah. Volume two is twice volume one.
Yes, volume one. We see how exhaustive this Hubert Harrison's efforts were to get the message across, to enlighten people, to bring people to a consciousness, a collective consciousness. And yet, so few people know about Hubert Harrison. I want to propose something. I don't know what your schedule looks like. We usually have our Free Your Mind Fridays sessions where people just opine about the issues of the day. I'd like to devote some portion of it to a Q&A with you on the materials you shared with us yesterday and today.
Sure. Let me just check the calendar, but off the top, I think that would be fine. I'm saying yes for now, and I'm assuming it will be. I'm checking it.
Okay. So it will just be questions based on your presentations yesterday and today. But I want to thank you so deeply for the work that you have done and continue to do in bringing this kind of knowledge to us and helping us understand that there's so much we need to know about our past, there's so much we need to know about people who have gone before us trying to get us in shape intellectually and ideologically. But you've done a masterful job. And these two books, again, I don't see how anybody could claim to have a library if they don't have them, by Theodore Allen and by Hubert Harrison. So thanks once again for being with us. I'll be in touch and we'll figure out how we work out on Friday. But thank you, thank you, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so very much, and thank you, your listeners. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. And I just wanted to share with you that I thought we should break the habit. It has become the habit to talk about, you know, great people. No, we need to talk about people who have done the work of informing our minds and giving us pathways that we need to follow. They have been in our among us, but we just refuse to recognize them. So we'll see each other tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening today. Bye-bye.